and even then every indication would be given that they would be commuted. But they would, on the contrary, be carried out without discussion. When Stalin was retreating on the question of a death sentence for Kamenev, he was taking the first steps to gain the same result by his alternative method. A group of Komsomol students in the town of Gorky, said to have planned an attempt on Stalin, was one of many arrested at this time. They had not actually done anything beyond discussion, but already even this made the death penalty a foregone conclusion. This group was confessing to the plots to kill Stalin by early November 1935, though without implicating any of the Zinovievite or other accused of the August 1936 Trial 1. The trial routine was about to be gone through when the case was held for further investigation, under instructions from the Secretariat. The NKVD selected this particular group because it had a ready-made way of linking the students with Trotsky, and hence of building a political conspiracy around them. The link was through one of its own men, Valentin Ulberg. Ulberg was a former agent of the Foreign Department of the NKVD, and had worked in Berlin as a secret informer among the Trotskyites. In 1930, he had attempted to get a post as Trotsky's secretary, one of the first of the many NKVD attempts to penetrate Trotsky's ménage, which ended in success in 1940. Since 1935, Ulberg had been working for the NKVD secret political department, exposing Trotskyite tendencies in the important Gorky Pedagogical Institute, where the students in question worked. His appointment had been opposed by the local party officials, in particular Yalin, head of the Provincial Committee's Propaganda and Education section, since Ulberg lacked qualifications and was a foreigner. Yalin, moreover, rightly complained that his documents seemed forged, and appealed to the Central Committee, but Yazhov then personally imposed Ulberg. By the beginning of 1936, the NKVD had made a good beginning in extending the scope of this Komsomol plot. Ulberg and some professors at the Institute were arrested. Ulberg, interrogated on 25 to 28 of January, denied all the charges. Eventually, he is reported ordered as a matter of party and police discipline to confess to being a link between the Gorky group and Trotsky. He was told that this was simply an NKVD assignment, and that whatever the verdict of the court he would be freed and given a post in the Far East. He then signed whatever was required of him. This was, in brief, that he had been sent by Trotsky to arrange the assassination of Stalin, recruiting professors and students to make the attempt when they went to Moscow for the 1936 May Day parade. The processing of the Ulberg case was not straightforward, and took time. Yalin, who knew too much, was executed without Trial 1, though he was to be mentioned several times during the public hearings. Ulberg's brother, P. Ulberg, was implicated, and his evidence was to be quoted in court, though he was not produced. Other accused included the head of the Pedagogical Institute, I. K. Fedotov. He confessed, but perhaps did not seem reliable enough to present in public, for he was not brought to trial. Nelidov, a teacher of chemistry who was required as the hypothetical maker of bombs, was not a communist and, in spite of violent pressure by one of the most vicious of the interrogators, the younger Kedrov, was not broken. But by late February 1936, Ulberg's story had been worked up into a usable version, and the NKVD definitely selected it as the basis of the plot. The head of the secret political department, G. A. Molchanov, now held a conference of about 40 NKVD executive officers. He told them that a vast conspiracy had been uncovered and that they would all be released from their ordinary duties and set to investigating it. The Politburo regarded the evidence as absolutely trustworthy, and the task was therefore simply to discover the details. The question of any accused being not guilty did not arise. The officers at once realized that the whole business was a frame-up, since they themselves were the men who had for years been in charge of supervision of the oppositionists, and they had detected no such activity. Moreover, if such a plot had come into being without their discovering it, they would clearly have been reprimanded at the very least. How little Stalin himself must have believed in the existence of any real plots was shown by the mere fact of his withdrawing so many of the most experienced officers from all the active departments of the secret police into what he knew to be an investigative farce. In the NKVD as it was now, Stalin had a powerful and experienced instrument. At its head stood Yagoda. His deputy in security matters was Stalin's crony Agranov, who had finished his special operations at Leningrad and handed over that city to the dreadful Zakovsky, who is said to have boasted that if he had Karl Marx to interrogate he would soon make him confess that he was an agent of Bismarck. The secret police machine proper was concentrated in the NKVD's chief administration of state security. This consisted of a highly organized array of departments, skilled in the ways of their trade, and practiced in all modes of investigation, interrogation, and falsification. Almost all its leading officers had been with it for a decade, and had coped with the great cases of the late 1920s and early 1930s. The NKVD controlled, in addition to this secret police machine, the militia, ordinary police, the frontier guards, its own internal troop formations, the fire service, and the labor camps, whose main administration, Gulag, under Matvei Berman, was already receiving a vast number of assorted purges. Yagoda and Agranov themselves, and Yazhov representing the Central Committee, played a prominent part in the organization of the trial, and Stalin personally conducted the key conferences. Under them, the secret political department was technically responsible for the whole operation, though it now had at its disposal the services of a number of officers from the other departments of state security, including their chiefs. The secret political department, which had been the kernel of the Chikov from the beginning, was still the key center of secret police operations. That is, it had the overall responsibility of supervising all the country's organizations and carrying on the political struggle against all hostile political elements. It was headed by G.A. Molchanov, an unscrupulous careerist, and his deputy, G.S. Loshkov. The economic department had security responsibility for all industry and agriculture, except for transport, dealt with by the transport department. In Soviet conditions, this gave it a role as weighty, in a general way, as that of the secret political department, and it had had the main responsibility for trials such as the Shalkti, which, though in a general sense political, were centered on economic crimes. Its head, L.G. Mironov, was a man with an extraordinary memory, which was to be of great use in composing and mastering the details of the first two trials. At the same time as he ran his vast department, he acted as assistant to Yagoda in the whole of the state security side of the NKVD. He is described as a conscientious party man who was depressed by the prosecution of the old Bolsheviks. Previous cases that he had organized, and which do not seem to have depressed him similarly, included the Industrial Party and the Metrovik trials, cases, with all their political importance, definable as economic. The Zinoviev trial had no economic component. Nevertheless, Mironov was given an important role. The operative department was responsible for guarding leading personnel and installations and investigating terrorist acts against them. Its main concern at this time was the protection of Stalin. Its head, K. V. Pauker, or his deputy, A. Ivalovich, was almost continually with him except when he was actually in his heavily guarded offices, and L. I. Chertok, one of their chief subordinates, also spent much time organizing his local defense. Pauker was a sort of evil buffoon. He had been a barber and valet to opera stars in Budapest, and had himself a turn for comic acting. Taken prisoner by the Russians in 1916, he had become one of the group of communists which emerged from that milieu. An ignorant and uneducated man without any political convictions, he was recruited to the Chikov, like so many other foreigners in those days, to work on searches and arrests. He rose by becoming a personal attendant again, this time to Menzhinsky, who came to rely on him and finally appointed him head of the Kremlin bodyguard and chief of the operative department. He was on close terms with Stalin, who even allowed him to shave him. The special department in general covered the armed forces. Its head was MIG. The foreign department dealt with espionage and terror abroad. Its head, A. Slutsky, was a sly intriguer who played an important role in the major interrogations. His deputies were Boris Berman and M. Shpigelglas. The transport department, under A.M. Shannon, was the only one not deeply involved, having its hands full with Kaganovich's endless purges on the railways. There was a good deal of flexibility in these arrangements. Postings between departments were fairly frequent. And reorganization involving the transfer of lesser matters between the departments was also quite common. Such was the order of battle of the shock troops of repression that Stalin was now launching on the helpless prisoners in the Lubyanka. They were assisted by another organization, the prosecutor's office. This had not been centralized on an all-union basis until 1933, when it became one of the most centralized bodies in the USSR, having all its legal agencies completely and uniformly subordinate to the prosecutor general in Moscow, who was now Vyshinsky. He announced his operative principle, that any discrepancies between the commands of the law and those of the revolution must be solved only by the subordination of the formal commands of law to those of party policy. His chief assistant was G. Rodzinsky, a fanatic who was to defend mass liquidation even after he himself had been purged and sent to a penal camp. By the end of February, the testimony of Olberg and others was satisfactory. One of those confessing, I. Trusov, had some of Trotsky's archives from the 1920s. Stalin now proposed to the Politburo that Yazhov should examine these and that the NKVD should question the accused together with comrade Yazhov. From now on, Yazhov plays a major role in the investigation. A former oppositionist, Isaac Reingold, chairman of the Cotton Syndicate, had been arrested as a Trotskyite in January or February. He was a friend of Sokolnikov's and was connected with Kamenev. A strong man, still only 38, he proved hard to break. He was interrogated for 3 weeks, often for periods of 48 hours at a time without sleep or food, bite your talk. The order to arrest his family was given in his presence. Finally, he was handed a death sentence and told it would be carried out automatically if he did not testify at once. He still refused to do so, but said that he would sign anything if so instructed by the party. Yagoda refused to accept these terms, and the interrogation dragged on. Finally, Yazhov intervened and personally ordered Reingold in the name of a central committee to provide the evidence required. The confessions had been obtained with some difficulty. Stalin is said to have brought about 300 former oppositionists from prisons and isolators for the NKVD to test for suitability as accused. By May, about 15 suitable confessions had been obtained, and more were coming in. In mid-May, Stalin held a conference with a number of the leading NKVD officials, and ordered the NKVD to produce further links with Trotsky. Molchanov, much to the anger of the Foreign Department, nominated two more NKVD agents, who had been working as its representatives in the German Communist Party and in the Comintern, Fritz David and Berman Urin. They were arrested in June and had no choice but to accept their instructions. They, too, claimed that they had each visited Trotsky and received orders from him to kill Stalin. Two more figures, Moisei Lurie, a scientist, and Nathan Lurie, a surgeon, whose conduct in court led even Western journalists to suspect them of being agents provocateurs, are also reported by fellow prisoners, in on different charges, as scarcely bothering to conceal this. Registered they, too, were supposed to be Trotskyite terrorists. With their evidence, a mass of material was now accumulating. The Trotskyite Zinovievite Center. In March, Yagoda had reported to Stalin on the liquidation of the Trotskyite underground in the exposure of the terrorist groups. On 31 March, Stalin instructed Yagoda and Vyshinsky to submit a concrete proposal on the trial of these Trotskyites, of whom they shortly gave 82 names. By April, the leading Trotskyites accused, I. N. Smirnov, Mreshkovsky, and Teravaganyan, were under interrogation. As was later pointed out, the center contained not a single one of the old political leaders from the Trotskyite side. Smirnov, Mreshkovsky, and Teravaganyan were all, however, men of repute in the party. Trotsky's army inspector general, the heroic giant Miralov, had been arrested on 17 April, and it was doubtless intended to use him too, but he held out until December, and this plan had to be postponed. Smirnov alone had been a member of the Central Committee, but he at least was a most distinguished old Bolshevik. A factory worker, he had been an active revolutionary from the age of 17, and had often been arrested. He had spent many years in Tsarist prisons and in Arctic exile. He had fought in the 1905 revolution, and in the Civil War had led the Fifth Red Army to its victory over Kolchak. Known as the Lenin of Siberia, he had ruled there for some years after the revolution. Smirnov had been proposed as the leading secretary of the party in 1922, just before the job went to Stalin. After being exiled with the other Trotskyites in 1927, he had recanted but, during the Ryudin period, had spoken approvingly of the proposals to remove Stalin and had been in jail ever since. Stalin thus had a particular grudge against him. Perhaps it was this that led Stalin to insist on his inclusion in the center in spite of the physical impossibility of his having participated in anything of the kind. For, as even Agranov is said to have tentatively objected, there would be some difficulty in making the charge plausible, since Smirnov had been held in jail throughout the period of the alleged plot. Stalin gave Agranov a sullen look and said, "Don't be afraid, that's all." Mreshkovsky had also fought in Siberia. He had run Trotsky's underground printing press in 1927, and had been the first oppositionist to be arrested. He was regarded as simply a fighter. He had been in jail since 1933. Teravaganyan, an intellectual Armenian described as both honest and unambitious, had fought with great distinction in the Revolution and Civil War, and afterward had reverted to ideology and journalism. He, too, had been in exile in Kazakhstan since 1933. A fourth Trotskyite was thrown in for some good measure, Dreitzer, the former head of Trotsky's bodyguard and prominent in the 1927 demonstrations. He was not accused of being a member of the center, but rather as the head organizer of assassin groups. The first examinations of the leading prisoners were a total failure. Smirnov had gone on hunger strike for 13 days on 8 May, and on 20 May was still replying, "I deny that, again I deny, I deny." Tervaganyan also twice undertook hunger strikes and wrote to Stalin that he had decided on suicide. Mrashkovsky's key interrogation is said to have lasted 90 hours, without result, though Stalin rang up at intervals to inquire how things were going. So far the case was entirely Trotskyite. Stalin now ordered the implication of the Zinovievites. Yagoda was later to be accused of rejecting the evidence against them, and Agranov, or so he was to say when attacking Yagoda and Molchanov in 1937, went behind his back to the Moscow provincial NKVD. He and Yazhov composed the full plan of the United that is Trotskyite and Zinovievite Center, and with A.P. Radzivilovsky and other leading figures in the Moscow NKVD he obtained the necessary confessions. Radzivilovsky wrote later that extraordinarily difficult work for 3 weeks on Dreitzer and Pichl was needed before they gave testimony. Although Yagoda at first rejected it, Agranov said that it was only thus that the investigation was put on the right track. Richard Pichl, formerly Zinoviev's secretary, had already given evidence in the Kremlin affair. A writer and playwright who had served in the Civil War, he became more cooperative when transferred to the Central NKVD, where a number of the leading figures were old friends of his. They promised him his life, an offer later confirmed by Yagoda. It was only in late June or early July that Zinoviev and his leading supporters were brought to Moscow from their isolators. At first Zinoviev made obdurate denials. Registered Bakayev made persistent denials. In general, all the genuine oppositionists refused to confess and pointed out that they had been in prison or exile in the remotest parts of the country during most of the period, and under close NKVD supervision during the rest of it. Molchanov then gave the interrogators to understand that earlier orders about not using unlawful means of interrogation were not to be taken too seriously. The interrogation of Zinoviev and Kamenev was put in charge of the most senior officials, Agranov, Molchanov, and Mironov. Zinoviev was ill at the time with a liver ailment, and the routine interrogation was postponed. He had once again written to the Politburo vaguely accepting responsibility for the assassination of Kirov. This was returned with an insistence on greater sincerity. With Kamenev, the attempt was made to secure a confession by ordinary interrogative methods. Mironov conducted it. But Kamenev resisted him in 9970. Spite of all his efforts, exposing Rheingold at a confrontation and in general standing firm, Mironov reported to Stalin that Kamenev was refusing to confess, and later gave an account of the conversation to a close acquaintance. "You think that Kamenev may not confess?" asked Stalin, his eyes slyly screwed up. "I don't know," Mironov answered. "He doesn't yield to persuasion." "You don't know?" inquired Stalin with marked surprise, staring at Mironov. "Do you know how much our state weighs, with all the factories, machines, the army, with all the armaments and the navy?" Mironov and all those present looked at Stalin with surprise. "Think it over and tell me," demanded Stalin. Mironov smiled, believing that Stalin was getting ready to crack a joke. But Stalin did not intend to jest. He looked at Mironov quite in earnest. "I am asking you, how much does all that weigh?" he insisted. Mironov was confused. He waited, still hoping Stalin would turn everything into a joke, but Stalin kept staring at him and waited for an answer. Mironov shrugged his shoulders and, like a schoolboy undergoing an examination, said in an irresolute voice, "Nobody can know that, Yosif Vissarionovich. It is in the realm of astronomical figures." "Well, and can one man withstand the pressure of that astronomical weight?" asked Stalin sternly. "No," answered Mironov. "Now then, don't tell me any more that Kamenev, or this or that prisoner, is able to withstand that pressure. Don't come to report to me," said Stalin to Mironov, "until you have in this briefcase the confession of Kamenev." 4. The transfer of Kamenev's case to the third-rate bully Chertok also produced no results, though the usual pressures of sleeplessness, semi-starvation, and general bullying must have begun to wear him down. The death of Gorky. Stalin planned to carry through the execution of the oppositionists regardless of possible revulsion in the party. For, as ever, he was prepared to deal with this by his usual combination of hardness and maneuver. The only figure who could not be handled in this fashion and who, if alive, would be difficult to silence, was Maxim Gorky, who remained until his death the only person whom Stalin was compelled to take into consideration, to some extent at least. It is possible that had he lived, the August trial might have had a different denouement. He had become ill on 31st of May, and died on 18th of June. When Gorky had opposed the October Revolution in 1917, Stalin had attacked him in a tone more venomous than any other Bolsheviks. He had even said, quite falsely, in an assault on an article of Gorky's entitled "I Cannot Keep Silent," that Gorky and his type had kept silent when landlords and capitalists were attacking the peasantry and the proletariat, that they reproached only the revolution and not the counter-revolution. Gorky's work had of course been one long blast at the ruling classes, and he had been associated with the Social Democrats from the start. Stalin went on to write that the revolution was quite prepared to throw away great names, including Gorky's, if necessary. Gorky's own views were by no means lacking in pugnacity. He several times remarked that if the enemy did not surrender he must be destroyed. Nevertheless, he had protected both Pilnyak and Zamyatin during the outcry against those writers in 1930, and this alone must have been very galling to Stalin, particularly in the case of Pilnyak, see here. And since then, more significantly still to our point, he had intervened strongly in favor of the policy of reconciliation and been an outspoken opponent of the earlier attempts to destroy Kamenev and Zinoviev. His mere existence was a factor strengthening the morale of Kamenev and others in their ordeal. His voice, they could be sure, would be raised against the new persecution of them, as soon as this became publicly known. To some degree, knowledge of this must have fortified their resistance. By the same token, his death at this particular time must have been a moral blow and must have made Stalin's task easier. As with Kuibyshev, we have a case of a death at a time very convenient to Stalin. Most deaths at times convenient to Stalin were so for the obvious reason. The doctors attending Gorky were later to be accused of murdering him on Yagoda's orders. When we come to the Bukharin trial of 1938, at which this charge was made, we shall consider the evidence, see here. Meanwhile, we may note that the current trial was held as soon after the necessary confessions as was feasible, and, moreover, seems to have been dated to suit the absence on holiday of some of the Politburo. If Gorky had hung on for even a few months, he would certainly have represented an impediment to Stalin's plans. The indefinite postponement of the trial would have been at the least awkward, and time would have been given for the mustering of opposition in the Central Committee. To have proceeded with the trial and not executed the oppositionists would have been contrary to Stalin's whole plan. But to have carried this out regardless would, with Gorky alive, have had disadvantages. A powerful voice would have supported and heartened the already restless elements in the leadership, and while it might have been possible, it would not have been easy to silence the writer. All such considerations are merely logical, and prove nothing. But Stalin was, in his way, a logical man. He was not averse to having people murdered, and his respect for literature was not such as to prevent his disposing of many other Russian writers of repute. We shall consider this suspicion later. Zinoviev surrenders. It now seemed suitable for Stalin to make a direct political approach to Zinoviev and Kamenev. Yazhov gave them what were represented as the Politburo's instructions, to disarm in a manner that will preclude any hope on your part of raising your head against the party ever again. The alternative was a trial by military court behind closed doors and the execution of the entire opposition, including the thousands in the camps. Zinoviev refused, and a similar attempt on Kamenev was also unsuccessful, though Yazhov this time directly threatened that Kamenev's son would be shot if he did not give in. A tighter interrogative routine was then inflicted on them. Yagoda had the heat put on in the cells, though the weather was now hot. Zinoviev's physical condition was very bad, and Kamenev was beginning to weaken under the threats to his son, whose arrest was finally ordered in his presence. In July, Zinoviev, after an all-night interrogation, asked to speak to Kamenev, and when they had discussed the matter they agreed to go on trial on condition that Stalin would confirm his promises to them, of executing neither themselves nor their followers, in the presence of the whole Politburo. This was accepted. However, when they were taken to the alleged Politburo meeting, only Stalin, Voroshilov, and Yazhov were present. Stalin explained that they formed a commission of the Politburo authorized to hear the case. This appeal to the Politburo and Stalin's partial evasion of it presents some interesting points. Both appeal and evasion suggest that there were still some men in the Politburo who might have been relied on to try to have its guarantees respected. In fact, it is curious that as late as the execution of Rudd's attack in 1938, some attempt at a similar appeal is suggested when we are told that he was not even called before the Central Committee Political Bureau because Stalin did not want to talk to him. Although shaken by the absence of the other Politburo members, the prisoners, after some argument, finally accepted Stalin's terms, which guaranteed their lives, the lives of their supporters, and the liberty of their families. A member of Zinoviev's family told Krivitsky that one reason for capitulation was to save his family, and in Kamenev's case the same is obviously true, and can be seen in his final plea. With the surrender of Zinoviev and Kamenev, the game was in Stalin's hands. The trial was on. The lesser political figures were expendable at a pinch, and in any case no stronger argument could be put to them than the willingness of their seniors to go along with the trial and accept Stalin's promises. Kamenev's own confession was underway on 13th of July, and presumably Zinoviev's too. Bakayev was confessing by 17th of July, Dritzer, by 23rd of July. Mreshkovsky was confessing by 20th of July, and on 21st of July he had a confrontation with Smirnov. There are two slightly different accounts of this. One of them, evidently based on the official record, has these old friends quarreling because of what Smirnov regarded as Mreshkovsky's weakness in surrendering. The other shows them as still on good terms at the end. In any case, Mreshkovsky made some such remark as "Why, Ivan Nikitich, you want to get out of a sordid bloody business with a clean shirt?" And Smirnov's firm comment was invention and slander. In spite of Smirnov's recalcitrance, the political preparation for the case could now go forward. On January 14, 1936 there had been a ruling from the Central Committee that all members should turn in their party documents for new ones, with a view to screening unworthy members. Now, on 29th of July, a top-secret letter of the Central Committee was sent out to provincial, territory, Republican, city, and district committees. It quoted confessions, some of them dated as late as 25th of July, by Zinoviev, Kamenev, Mreshkovsky, Bakayev, Pikel, Dritzer, Berman Urin, and Laurier, M. Laurier, and Rheingold, but not Smirnov, among those who were to appear in court, together with Karev, Motorin, Esterman, Kuklin, and others to be implicated but not produced. The picture presented was of a detailed array of assassinations planned by the Trotskyite, Zinovievite bloc, to be carried out by numbers of named accomplices, and in particular the Kirov murder. In some respects, it gave a fuller account than that of the official publication of the trial itself. The letter also pointed out that several of those now under arrest had, in spite of all previous measures, managed to keep their party cards, though all boundaries have been obliterated between spies, provocateurs, white guards, kulaks and the Trotskyites and Zinovievites. It called for a renewal of revolutionary vigilance, and asserted firmly the main duty of the party membership in the forthcoming period. The inalienable quality of every Bolshevik under present conditions should be the ability to recognize an enemy of the party, no matter how well he may be masked. On receiving the circular, local officials began a further round of feverish dilation. The first secretary of Kosyalsk Raion, for example, wrote to the provincial committee denouncing not only local inhabitants, but also people he had met in previous posts and now thought suspicious, commenting in each case, "It is possible that up to this time he has not been unmasked." This was, in fact, the political preparation of the party branches throughout the country for the campaign about to be launched, in connection with the Zinoviev trial, against all the enemies of the general secretary. As one result, even longer lists of anti-Soviet elements than those already in existence were compiled everywhere, and the mass purge began to get underway. Meanwhile Smirnov, incriminated in the secret letter, was still giving trouble. A Soviet periodical has lately printed excerpts from Smirnov's NKVD interrogations. He denied that his alleged organization existed. When told that he had sent out directives through his mother when in prison in 1935, he replied, "A lie." He admitted that he had, evidently in 1932, received a letter from Trotsky, and had answered it. Trotsky had written about the rise of fascism, and Smirnov had written back about the situation in the Soviet Union, and nothing more. Further pressure was brought on Smirnov through his former wife, Alexandra Safonova, also implicated. She was brought to a confrontation with him in Gay's office, where she pleaded with him to go to trial. Since Kamenev and Zinoviev had already confessed, she is also said to have argued, it would be best for him to stick with them and go to public trial, in which case there would be no question of shooting them. Safonova had accepted the argument that the opposition must disarm when Yezhov, as secretary of the Central Committee, had told her that her evidence was needed by the party, and she followed instructions. She now said that in 1930 and 1931 Smirnov, Tervaganyan, Mreshkovsky, and she had formed a Trotskyite center with terrorist aims, that Trotsky had sent directives with that purpose, and that Smirnov had spoken in their home of the need to kill Stalin. Smirnov replied, as before, that he had met Trotsky's son in Berlin and had exchanged letters with Trotsky, but that there had never been any terrorist plans, and that no center ever existed. Safonova then said, "You, Ivan Nikitich, want to hide in the bushes. You don't want to disarm." Smirnov answered, "Oh, sure. I want to die at peace." Equals. Smirnov seems also to have been confronted with Zinoviev, who said he was confessing and argued in favor of Smirnov doing so too. Zinoviev said that he really believed that his admissions would open the way to his returning to the party, and that Stalin, whom he referred to by his old party nickname of Kobay, was at present the focus of the party's will, and would come to a compromise with the opposition, since in practice he could not do without the Leningrad in the long run. Smirnov replied that, on the contrary, it was obvious that the Politburo wanted the physical annihilation of the opposition, otherwise there was no point in the case. The interrogator told Smirnov that it was useless for him to resist, as there were plenty of witnesses against him. And, moreover, it was not only Smirnov but his family too that would suffer, as the assassin Nikolaevs had suffered. Smirnov knew nothing of the arrest of his family and took this simply to be a disgusting threat by the interrogator. But shortly afterward, on his way to an interrogation, he saw his daughter Olga at the other end of the corridor, held by two guards. She is reported later in prison. Her mother, Smirnov's wife Varvara, was sent to a women's camp at Kotlas and was shot in the camp in April or May 1938, during a mass execution of 1,300 undesirables. However, his former wife, Safonova, who had testified against him, remained alive but imprisoned, until 1958, when she described her testimony as 90% lies. Under all these pressures, Smirnov finally gave way, but he would only consent to make a partial confession. This would not have been accepted from anyone else, but time was getting short and Stalin wanted Smirnov in the trial at all costs. Smirnov also managed to have Safonova removed from the list of defendants, and she only appeared as a witness. All this rankled with Stalin, and Yagoda and Mironov were later charged with having shielded Smirnov. By 5 August, Smirnov was well into his confession. Even now, a final decision on who would appear in the trial had not been taken. On 7 August, Vyshinsky presented a formal indictment of 12 named accused. Stalin corrected some of the phraseology, and added Luria twice, upon which the two Lurais were included. The revised indictment, presented to Stalin on 10 August, thus had 14 names. He then added those of Derevyanin and Yevdokimov. Neither had been mentioned in the secret letter of 29 July. Yevdokimov had not even been questioned about the case. He is said to have been treated with particular brutality, in view, doubtless, of the short notice. On 11 August, the official orders for holding the trial were given by the Central Executive Committee, and the final indictment is dated 14 August. On the same day, Derevyanin, who had vaguely admitted the existence of the center on 16 July, was making a full confession. The last confessions were eased, and the earlier ones fortified, on 11 August by a decree which, going back, to some extent, on that of December 1, 1934, re-established public hearings in the use of lawyers, and allowed appeals from the accused for 3 days after the sentence. The timing of this decree is decisive. While clearly intended to strengthen the accused's hope that a reprieve would be granted, it was also designed, of course, to put the same idea about among the apprehensive party membership. These included some of the interrogators themselves. It seems that reassurances that no death sentences would be carried out were believed by, for example, Boris Berman, and that this led him to quite sincere advice to Derevyanin that the best course open to him was to surrender. And with the publication of the indictment on 15 August, it was at last necessary to take such measures as would best put the case over to the party as a whole. The preparatory work had been done in great secrecy. There was no preliminary discussion in the Politburo. The trial came as a complete surprise not only for the rank and file of party workers but also to members of the Central Committee and some members of the Politburo, in the sense that they were only informed about it when the secret letter of 29 July reached them. To objectors in the current leadership, Stalin now had a simple answer: the matter was in the hands of the prosecutor and the court. It was they who were so keen on legality, after all. They must let justice take its course. And the 11th of August decree was a considerable reassurance. Opposition to the trial would in any case have been very difficult to organize once confessions had been obtained. But Stalin played safe by springing it on the country when he himself was on holiday, and many of the rest of the leadership were also scattered around the country. Molotov and Kalinin, for example, are said to have gone on holiday in ignorance of the forthcoming massacre. Whether this is true of Molotov in quite this form seems dubious. However that may be, there now came a startling proof that Stalin was discontented with him. In the party when the secret letter arrived, and among the public when the indictment came out, a sensation was caused by the omission from the list of those the conspirators were planning to kill of one important Soviet leader, Molotov. Stalin, Orjonikidze, Voroshilov, Kaganovich, Kosyur, Postishev, and Zhdanov were named, the last three specifically as the targets of local terrorist branches in the Ukraine and Leningrad, but not the Soviet premier. Right through the trial, the confessions gave the same listing, and it was repeated in Vyshinsky's final speech for the prosecution. In Soviet conditions this was taken to mean, and without any doubt it all really meant, that Molotov was in disfavor. An NKVD defector account says that Stalin crossed Molotov's name out of the early evidence, where it had naturally been included, with his own hand, and that Yagoda then instructed the interrogators not to bring it in again. This story must be substantially true. Without a personal decision of Stalin's, Molotov could not have been omitted. There seem grounds for supposing that Molotov had in some way dragged his feet about the plan to destroy the old Bolsheviks. And the episode lends at least some credence to the reports that in the discussions about the Ryutin case in 1932 he had not wholeheartedly supported Stalin in calling for extreme measures. Thus from around May 1936 until the end of the trial in August, Molotov faced elimination. He went on his holiday under careful NKVD supervision. Some weeks after the Zinoviev trial, he seems to have returned to favor. His name was included as a target of the conspirators in the 1937 and 1938 trials, even though this raised the anomaly that the later batches of conspirators had allegedly plotted with Zinoviev and Kamenev for this purpose, but Zinoviev and Kamenev had inexplicably omitted to confess it. Stalin's pressure had brought Molotov to heel. Henceforth, there were no reports of anything but enthusiastic complicity on his part in the Great Purge. Why Stalin saved him cannot be more than guessed at. He was, of course, or was to be after Orjonikidze's removal, the only old Bolshevik of any repute at all among Stalin's ruling group. Meanwhile, it was impossible for Molotov, or anyone else, to interfere with the trial, though they could hope that it would end merely with prison sentences. The trial begins. At 10 minutes after midday on August 19, 1936, the trial opened before a session of the Military Collegium of the Supreme Court in the little October Hall of the Trade Union House, chosen in preference to the huge Hall of Columns, which had been the scene of earlier show trials. A large, high, bright room, decorated rather floridly in the Russian 19th-century style with white Corinthian columns and light blue walls, it had formerly been one of the ballrooms of what was then the Nobles' Club. In this small hall there was room for no more than 150-odd Soviet citizens and 30-odd foreign journalists and diplomats. The foreign audience was crucial to the show. Unanimously hostile criticism might have prevented further performances. Too many of these privileged witnesses allowed themselves to be taken in by an improbable plot and incredible details. The Soviet spectators were all selected by the NKVD and were, in fact, mainly NKVD clerks and officials. Many officials of the Central Committee and the government were not able to get in. Nor were relatives of the accused. We are told of a later trial, Bukharin's, that the first five rows were occupied by members of the NKVD. At such trials, we hear, the NKVD officers responsible for the accused sat in front of them. This apparently means facing them closely, in the first row of the audience, we are definitely told this of one later accused. This crowd is reported to have been under instructions to raise a commotion at a given signal, which might be necessary if any untoward outbreak from one of the prisoners took place. The court commandant, in uniform tunic and breeches, and wearing the magenta hatband and collar tabs of the NKVD, called the court to order. Everyone stood, and the judges took their seats. Presiding was Ulrich, a fat man, with dewlaps like a bloodhound and little pig eyes. His shaven head rose to a point. His neck bulged over the collar of his uniform. His voice was soft and oily. He had much experience in political cases. On his right was another veteran of these trials, Matchilovich, who had presided over the mass slaughter of the Leningrad White Guards in December 1934. On his left was a figure of great interest to Westerners, the unimpressive, thin-faced divisional military jurist Ion Nikitchenko. 10 years later, he was to appear on the Supreme Allied Tribunal at Nuremberg, with the most distinguished judges of Britain, America, and France, to preside over the trial of Göring and others. He represented a judicial tradition so different from that of the rest of the tribunal that his mere presence may be thought to have made a mockery of those proceedings. One important respect in which Soviet justice differed from that practiced by his future colleagues in Nuremberg was that sentences had been prepared beforehand by non-judicial authorities. The vicious practice was condoned of having the NKVD prepare lists of persons whose cases were under jurisdiction of the military collegium and whose sentences were prepared in advance. Yazhov would send these lists to Stalin personally for his approval of the proposed punishment. He approved these lists. It was even the case that Kaganovich, before court sittings on various cases had come to an end, would personally edit the draft sentences and arbitrarily insert charges that suited him, such as allegations that acts of terrorism had been planned against his person, while Molotov is described as personally changing a sentence on a wife of an enemy of the people from imprisonment to death when the list went through his hands. In the case now before Nikitchenko and his colleagues, there is no reason to doubt that the sentences were part of the original script, and had been imposed by the General Secretary himself. Three large and healthy NKVD soldiers, with rifles and fixed bayonets, escorted the prisoners to the dock, behind a low wooden bar along the right-hand wall of the courtroom, and took up positions guarding them. The accused had gained a little weight and caught up on their sleep in the few days past. But they still looked pale and worn. Just before the trial, Yagoda and Yazhov had a conference with Zinoviev, Kamenev, Yevdokimov, Bakayev, Mrashkovsky, and Teravaganyan. Yazhov repeated Stalin's assurance that their lives would be spared, and also warned them that a single attempt at treachery would be regarded as implicating the whole group. Now they sat, ill at ease among the agents provocateurs scattered among them and separating them. The practice of trying a group of important political prisoners with various second-rate crooks, or alleged crooks, as though they formed one group, is an old technique. At the trial of Danton and the moderates on 13 and 14 Germinal, he and his four closest followers were mingled in with men accused as thieves and common spies, and each was carefully linked with the others by joint accusations. The Soviet press was doing just such a job. An angry and violent campaign filled the papers in which, meanwhile, other and contrary themes were appearing, in particular, almost daily photographs of a series of airmen, like those of the astronauts a generation later. These were men like Chkalov, who with his crew flew a new Soviet plane on a round tour of the country to the Far East and back, and Kakinaki, who produced a series of altitude records. They were photographed with Stalin and others, being received in the Politburo, being awarded orders, and simply on their own. Through them, an air of youth and progress, of the triumph of the young Stalinist generation, was projected at the same time as the forces of darkness represented by the old Bolsheviks were being dissipated. At the side of the room, opposite the doomed representatives of anti-Stalinism, Vyshinsky sat at a small table, with his trim gray mustache and hair, neatly dressed in stiff white collar and well-cut dark suit. Ulrich went through the formalities of identification and asked if there were objections to the court and if the accused wanted defending lawyers. The answer to both questions was a unanimous negative. The secretary of the court then read the indictment. This based itself on the trial of January 1935, at which, it said, Zinoviev and his colleagues had concealed their direct responsibility for the Kirov murder. The since revealed circumstances showed that they and the Trotskyites, who had practiced terrorism earlier still, had formed a united bloc at the end of 1932. The bloc had been joined also by the Lominaje group. They had received instructions, through special agents, from Trotsky. In fulfilling them, they had organized terrorist groups which had prepared a number of practical measures for the assassination of Stalin, Voroshilov, Kaganovich, Kirov, or Orjonikidze, Zhdanov, Kosyr, Postishev, and others. One of these terrorist groups had actually murdered Kirov. They had no program other than murder. Trotsky had sent written instructions to Dreitzer, who had passed them to Mrashkovsky, to assassinate Stalin and Voroshilov. The five junior accused, together with Holtzman, had been personally sent by Trotsky or his son Sadolf to assist in these acts. Ulberg, in addition, had contacts with the Gestapo. All the accused had fully admitted their guilt, with the exception of Ian Smirnov, whose full guilt was, however, proved by the confessions of the other accused. He had made only a partial confession, of belonging to the United Center and being personally connected with Trotsky up to the time of his arrest in 1933, and of having received, in 1932, instructions from Trotsky to organize terror. He had denied, however, taking part in terroristic activities. The indictment concluded by mentioning various names of accused who were to be tried separately, the cases of Gerdek, Grinberg, Ygavin, Karev, Kuzmichev, Constant, Matorin, Paul Ulberg, Radin, Safonova, Fivilevich, D. Schmidt and Esterman, in view of the fact that investigation is still proceeding, have been set aside for separate trial. Equals Matorin, who had been Zinoviev's private secretary, was elsewhere said to be still under investigation with a view to later trial in connection with another case. None of them was ever to come to public trial, and in most cases we know nothing whatever of their fate. After the reading of the indictment, the accused pleaded guilty on all counts, with the exception of Smirnov and Holtzman. Smirnov admitted to having belonged to the center and to having received terrorist instructions from Trotsky, but again denied participation in preparing or executing terrorist acts. Holtzman, too, though admitting having brought terrorist instructions from Trotsky, denied himself participating in terrorism. After a 15-minute recess, Mrashkovsky was called upon to testify. Under Vyshinsky's questioning, he recounted the formation of the center and the planning of terrorism under instructions from Trotsky and his son Sadov, partly passed through Smirnov and partly by a letter from Trotsky in invisible ink sent to him through Dreitzer. Under Smirnov there had been formed a Trotskyite group consisting of himself, Mrashkovsky, Tervaganyan, and Safonova. Dreitzer joined them, and they had a number of lesser agents. When Mrashkovsky implicated Smirnov in direct terrorist activity, Smirnov several times denied the evidence, and there were warm wrangles between him and Vyshinsky. Zinoviev, called on to confirm the story, added that the murder of Kirov had been a joint enterprise involving both Zinovievites and Trotskyites, including Smirnov. Kamenev also confirmed this. The joint terror network was thus sketched out right at the start of the trial. For good measure, Mrashkovsky also implicated Lominaje, who had committed suicide the previous year, equals and a Red Army group of assassins headed by divisional commander Dmitry Schmidt. This latter charge was to be of far-reaching significance. Mrashkovsky was followed by Yevdokimov, who said he had deceived the court in January 1935. He then explained how he, Bakayev, Zinoviev, and Kamenev had organized the Kirov assassination. The plan had been to get Stalin at the same time. Bakayev warned Nikolaev and his accomplices that they must wait for Zinoviev's signal, said Yevdokimov, that they must fire simultaneously with the shots to be fired in Moscow and Kiev. Equals, Mrashkovsky had been quoted in the indictment as having said at the preliminary examination that Stalin was to be killed first, but in any case Kirov was not supposed to precede the general secretary to the grave. Yevdokimov for the first time involved the old Bolshevik Grigory Sokolnikov, former candidate member of the Politburo and still a candidate member of the Central Committee. In the course of Yevdokimov's evidence, Smirnov, once more implicated, again denied the testimony. At the evening session, Dreitzer recounted his connections with Sadov and his organization of two other terrorist groups for killing Stalin and Voroshilov, respectively. As to Smirnov, Trotsky's deputy in the USSR, Dreitzer remarked harshly, "There could be no acting on one's own, no orchestra without a conductor among us." I am surprised at the assertions of Smirnov, who, according to his words, both knew and did not know, spoke and did not speak, acted and did not act. This is not true. Smirnov again denied the evidence, and said he had not discussed terrorism with Dreitzer. Zinoviev was again called to confirm Smirnov's role, and did so at length. Rheingold, who followed, extended the conspiracy further, speaking of negotiations with Rykov, Bukharin, and Tomsky, and mentioning yet two more terrorist groups, headed by the rightist Slepkov and Izmont. He went on to tell of a plan of Zinoviev and Kamenev to put Bakayev in charge of the NKVD on their coming to power so that he could kill all police officials who might be in possession of the threads of the controversy, and also all the direct perpetrators of the terroristic acts, an interesting sign, as we have noted, of the way Stalin's mind was working. Bakayev, who followed, confessed to having organized the Kirov murder and planned that of Stalin. Vyshinsky, did you take a number of practical measures to carry out these instructions, namely, to organize several attempts on the life of Comrade Stalin, which failed through no fault of yours? Bakayev, that is so. But he introduced a note of reservation, of a type to be found in later cases, when he said that the other plots now attributed to the accused he had learned of for the first time when he read the indictment. He also had some lesser reservations, saying, for example, that he did not go to Leningrad to meet Vladimir Levin, one of the Nikolaev group, for terrorist reasons. These minor denials could count for nothing against the major admissions. Nevertheless, they can still perhaps be treated as slight and pathetic signals that the evidence was not to be relied on. Baikal came next. He had agreed, he said, to take part in an attempt on Stalin's life. He mentioned a tragedy of 1933, when Zinoviev's secretary, Bogdan, had committed suicide as a protest against the party purge then going on. A new interpretation was now imposed on this, through Piker's mouth. Bogdan had indeed left a note making it appear that he was a victim of the party cleansing, but in fact he had been ordered by Bakayev either to attempt Stalin's life or to commit suicide. Even this extravagant tale roused no incredulity from some of those present in the press box. Baikal had been away in Spitsbergen, as a member of the Union of Soviet Writers. He had been on assignment to do some work on the Soviet mining concession there. This was represented as an attempt to keep clear in order to avoid discovery. Thus when a man was away, this proved that he was a terrorist trying to escape discovery, and when he came back, as Paikal did, he was a terrorist resuming work, in this case further attempts on the lives of Kaganovich, Voroshilov, and others. Next morning, 20th of August, Kamenev gave his evidence. He spoke at first with a certain dignity, but as the cross-questioning went on, this began to collapse. He made an almost complete confession, repudiating only the idea that the plotters had intended to cover the traces of their crimes by physically exterminating NKVD men and others who might know about them. About Smirnoff's denials, he said, "It is ridiculous wriggling, which only creates a comical impression." In Rheingold's evidence, Sokolnikov had been named as a full member of the center. However, Kamenev now put it slightly differently. Kamenev, among the leaders of the conspiracy, another person may be named who in point of fact was one of the leaders, but who, in view of the special plans we made in regard to him, was not drawn into the practical work. I refer to Sokolnikov. Wyshynsky, who was a member of the center, but whose part was kept a strict secret. Kamenev, yes. Knowing that we might be discovered, we designated a small group to continue our terroristic activities. For this purpose we designated Sokolnikov. It seemed to us that on the side of the Trotskyites this role could be successfully performed by Serebrakov and Radek. He also extended the conspiracy to include the former workers' opposition group of Shliapnikov. On the involvement of the rightists, he said. In 1932, 1933 and 1934 I personally maintained relations with Tomsky and Bukharin and sounded their political sentiments. They sympathized with us. When I asked Tomsky about Rykov's frame of mind, he replied, "Rykov thinks the same as I do." In reply to my question as to what Bukharin thought, he said, "Bukharin thinks the same as I do, but is pursuing somewhat different tactics. He does not agree with the line of the party, but is pursuing tactics of persistently enrooting himself in the party and winning the personal confidence of the leadership." This was not a complete incrimination, in theory at least, but it could hardly be regarded as meaning anything other than an intention by Stalin to bring Bukharin and his associates into dock. A witness, Professor Yakovlev, was next produced, to corroborate the testimony. Kamenev, he said, had put him in charge of a terrorist group at the Academy of Sciences. Zinoviev was now called on for his evidence in chief. He appeared cowed. The formerly eloquent orator was hardly able to speak. He looked puffy and gray, and gasped asthmatically. His confession was complete, involving him not only in the Zinovievite terrorist groups, but also with M. Lurier, allegedly sent by Trotsky. He invoked Tomsky's name unambiguously, and also named Smilga, the veteran member of Lenin's Central Committee who had led the Baltic Fleet in the seizure of power. He asserted that he was in constant communication with Smirnoff, adding, "In this situation I had meetings with Smirnoff, who has accused me here of frequently telling untruths. Yes, I often told untruths. I started doing that from the moment I began fighting the Bolshevik Party. Insofar as Smirnoff took the road of fighting the party, he too is telling untruths. But it seems, the difference between him and myself is that I have decided firmly and irrevocably to tell at this last moment the truth, whereas he, it seems, has adopted a different decision. Plus pound." Next came, as witness only, Smirnov's former wife, Safonova. She said that Smirnov had transmitted Trotsky's instructions on terrorism and strongly supported them. Smirnov firmly denied both assertions, but others of the accused backed her up. Vyshynsky then questioned Smirnov. Wyshynsky, what were your relations with Safonova? Smirnov, good. Wyshynsky, and more? Smirnov, we were intimately related. Wyshynsky, you were husband and wife? Smirnov, yes. Wyshynsky, no personal grudges between you? Smirnov, no. At the afternoon session, Smirnov was the first to be questioned. He continued with his partial confession. He had passed on Trotsky's and Sadov's ideas about terrorism, but he had not shared them, and he had done nothing else. I admit that I belonged to the underground Trotskyite organization, joined the Bloc, joined the center of this Bloc, met Sadov in Berlin in 1931, listened to his opinion on terrorism and passed this opinion on to Moscow. I admit that I received Trotsky's instructions on terrorism from Gavin and, although not in agreement with them, I communicated them to the Zinovievites through Ter. Vaganyan. Shinsky, ironically, when did you leave the center? Smirnov, I did not intend to resign, there was nothing to resign from. Wyshynsky, did the center exist? Smirnov, what sort of center? Wyshynsky, Mrashkovsky, did the center exist? Mrashkovsky, yes. Wyshynsky, Zinoviev, did the center exist? Zinoviev, yes. Wyshynsky, Yevdokimov, did the center exist? Yevdokimov, yes. Wyshynsky, Bakayev, did the center exist? Bakayev, yes. Wyshynsky, how, then? Smirnov, can you take the liberty to maintain that no center existed? Smirnov again said that no meetings of such a center had taken place, and again three of the other members of it were made to bear him down. After the evidence of the others that it was he who had been head of the Trotskyite side of the conspiracy, he turned to them sardonically and said, "You want a leader? Well, Take me. Even Vyshinsky commented that this was said in rather a jocular way. Smirnov's partial confession was a rather difficult position to maintain, but on the whole he succeeded in confusing the issue. When the contradictions in his stance became awkward, he simply did not answer the questions. Ulberg, next, told of his long membership in the German Trotskyite organization, through which he had met Sadolf and by means of a forged Honduran passport had got to Russia. He gave no explanation of how, with 99,131, a tourist visa on a Central American passport, he had got a job at the Gorky Pedagogical Institute, but there he had organized the terrorist act to be committed in Moscow on May Day 1936. Ulberg's plan to assassinate Stalin failed because he had been arrested. A peculiar item in Vyshinsky's closing speech, not given in the compressed English version, was a piece of material evidence involving Ulberg. This was the visiting card of Vladimir Tukhalevsky, director of the Slavic Library of the Czechoslovak Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Tukhalevsky wrote in the Prague press that Ulberg had indeed done work in the library at various dates from 1933 to the spring of 1935. The visiting card, Vyshinsky said, had on it the letters PNF and the date 1936, which served as a code or password previously agreed on between Ulberg and Tukhalevsky. This was supposedly discovered in Stalinabad, where Ulberg had earlier worked in the Pedagogical Institute. What it was supposed to prove is unclear, and its omission in the English version is understandable. Ulberg was one of those of whom it was noted even at the time that his evidence was given in an almost jaunty fashion. Fritz David and the two Lorais made the same mistake. Several observers at once concluded that they were agents provocateurs. Following Ulberg, Berman Urin gave evidence that Trotsky had personally sent him to shoot Stalin at a Comintern plenum. He gave a very detailed account of meetings with Trotsky and his entourage in Copenhagen in November 1932. This evidence had been constructed by the NKVD as follows. Jack Sobel, the Soviet spy whose career only ended with his arrest in 1957 in New York, had infiltrated Trotsky's circle in 1931. He met him for the last time in Copenhagen in December 1932 when Trotsky had been admitted there on a short lecture tour. Sobel then lost Trotsky's confidence. But his account of Trotsky's moves in Copenhagen, as transmitted to the NKVD, was edited to form the basis of Berman Urin's evidence. Berman Urin concluded by saying that he had been unable to get a ticket for the 12th plenum at the Comintern, and so could not shoot Stalin after all. Ever since the publication of the indictment, the Soviet press had been violently demanding the death penalty. Resolutions from all over the country came in and were printed. Workers in the Kiev Red Flag Factory and the Stalingrad Dzerzhinsky Tractor Works, Kazakh Kolchoses and Leningrad Party organizations, calling for the shooting of the accused, day by day made an overwhelming build-up. Now, on the morning of 21 August, Pravda carried something new. There were still dozens of mass resolutions, and the usual hack verses by the poet Astor Demyanbedny, with the title No Mercy. But, in addition, there were manifestos from Rakovsky, Rykov, and Pyatakov, which showed another aspect of party discipline. They, too, all demanded the death penalty. Rakovsky's was headed No Pity, Rykov insisted that no mercy be shown to Zinoviev. The tone of all may be judged from Pyatakov's contribution, which said, "One cannot find the words fully to express one's indignation and disgust. These people have lost the last semblance of humanity. They must be destroyed like carrion which is polluting the pure, bracing air of the land of the Soviets, dangerous carrion which may cause the death of our leaders, and has already caused the death of one of the best people in our land, that wonderful comrade and leader S.M. Kirov. Many of us, including myself, by our heedlessness, our complacency and lack of vigilance toward those around us, unconsciously helped these bandits to commit their black deeds. It is a good thing that the People's Commissariat of Internal Affairs had exposed this gang. It is a good thing that it can be exterminated. Honor and glory to the workers of People's Commissariat of Internal Affairs." Under these mounting pressures, the accused continued with their evidence. For 21st of August, the last day of testimony, only one leading figure, Tervaganyan, remained. Otherwise, there were three more assassins and Trotsky's alleged emissary, Holtzman. Holtzman, a genuine ex-Trotskyite of junior rank, was a personal friend of Smirnov's. His evidence turned out to be highly unsatisfactory to the prosecution, on two grounds. First, no doubt under the influence of Smirnov's example, he had already reverted from the complete confession the indictment had attributed to him to a refusal to admit that he was implicated in terrorism. He now said flatly that though he had passed it on, he, like Smirnov, did not share Trotsky's point of view about the necessity of terror. Vyshinsky was only able to get him to admit that he had remained a member of the Trotskyite organization, and alleged that this amounted to the same thing. The second point was different. Holtzman confessed that he had met Sadolf in Copenhagen. In that city, he had arranged to put up at the Hotel Bristol and to meet him there. I went to the hotel straight from the station and in the lounge met Sadolf. When Holtzman's